Let's start off here because, again, we tried to go in this thing as much all around as we possibly could in there. We start off, let's start by taking a look here tonight at some of the bigger news stories of the last decade. One of the things that really struck me, and again, I ended up being the editor of this sucker and, kind of coordinating the stuff, probably, in a similar type role, with this show, of trying to tie some stuff together. So some of the features in there I ended up writing. This was one where it just really struck me that when I went to try to rank the biggest news stories of the last decade, it really kind of grabbed me when I kind of compared it to the 90s, when I compared it to the 80s. The top four stories of the decade, as I saw it, and if this was a fantasy sports board draft board, we would have a line under those top four probably. That would be your top tier, and you might change it to a different order, but this is how I had it: 9/11, the financial crash / Great Recession, the Iraq War, Hurricane Katrina, and then from there, I got it. Number five is more of a general one: technological change. The internet, everything like that. And then from there, it starts to, the Bush-Gore recount battle was also, relatively high up there in the top 10. But those four, what just really struck me about that is, you've got one, let's look at number three, the Iraq War, number four, Hurricane Katrina. Geez, those are probably bigger than anything that happened in the 90s or maybe even the 80s. I mean, you've got, any one of the top four here would have been, I got to think, maybe number one in the 90s, number one in the 80s, number three, number four could have been way up there. I mean, I might be missing something. I mean, I'm thinking back here, you had an impeachment of the president in the late 90s, but it didn't seem like by later in the year anybody even much remembered it. You had the first Gulf War, which was successful and relatively short-lived, the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was big, but am I missing something, Ryan, or would most of these things dwarf the things in other decades?
I think the only thing that might have even come close was intern gate at the White House.
Okay.
Something along those lines with Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. I mean, if you think back, that was a huge story back then.
Yeah.
I don't think we had any natural disasters. The
Oklahoma City bombing was big.
Well, yeah, but the scope, natural disasters,
that was no
the scope
9/11,
of Katrina,
yeah.
Nothing like what happened in New York City. There were similar things, and I don't want to make light of the Oklahoma City bombing and make it minuscule.
No, we're not diminishing that.
But it is even close to the scope of what happened in New York City.
No, and not only that, too, you're mentioning New York, and that's the most visible part of it, of course. But, I mean, that's two airplanes out of four. You got another one in the side of the Pentagon, and you got another one in a field in Pennsylvania, and a heroic story behind that of where the passengers, unless you believe the conspiracy theories that it was shot down, the common story tends to be the passengers took it down because that sumbitch was headed for either the White House, the Capitol building, whatever. New York is the horrific part that all sticks in our minds, but there was two more airplanes on top of that, Ryan. That just shows you again the magnitude of it.
Well, not only the two airplanes on top of that, but you remember back to that day. The Oklahoma City bombing, it's a big deal in American history. But, Rick, if I look at you and say, where were you the day that the Oklahoma City bombing happened, you're going to give me a blank stare. If I sit here and I go, Rick, where were you at and what were you doing on September 11th, 2001, you're going to know exactly where you were, what you were doing, and you'll remember the events of the day. And not only the planes that you have mentioned, but you'll remember that, there was just this entire scaredom across the United States of America and all the planes, there will be no planes going up.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the military planes swarming the United States looking for other planes that might be out there that they need to look for to see if maybe there were other attacks planned. In the scope of things, it's so much bigger than Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
Like I said, Oklahoma City is no joke.
Right,
Oklahoma
right.
City was a big deal. And Timothy McVeigh was a big deal.
Columbine was, yeah. I mean, these things were, but yeah.
And the only other thing is, the only other thing I can kind of think of that might even be in there is, if you go back to 4/20/99, which was the Columbine thing.
Right.
You go back and you look at Columbine. Columbine in the 90s was that big deal. Because if you think about it, yeah, there were a few school shootings here and there, but Columbine is really the one that set off the rash of school shootings, and it was the biggest of the school shootings.
It was really, you know, it was a traumatizing thing, and I just, it really shook people. I think I've referenced this before on the show. I mean, it shook me such that I remember, like, not long after it happened, you know, I drove out to, you know, this was like a year or two after I'd bought my condo, so I guess I was already stuck with what I've got. But I drove out and was, like, looking at places out in the country. I was specifically targeting out by, like, Lodi, Ohio, because that was an area that I'd driven through. My family had driven through when we were younger, you know, on our way to Amish country. I was thinking about that, about just maybe moving out to the country. Like, do I want to live in regular society anymore? Would I want to bring up kids in an area, you know, where this kind of stuff could happen? And I guess that's a naive thought, because as we've seen in the last decade, these things have happened in rural areas too. But that's just, it just shook me to such a way that, like, man, I don't think I want to bring up kids in this society.
Well, and you know, the other thing, I think the bigger scope of Columbine, really, I mean, we're kind of going back now into the 90s. And, you know, the original thought was there a story in the 90s that would have made the top four in the 2000s? The larger scope of Columbine, and I guess you'd have to go back and look at the numbers and look at the statistics, the Columbine scare, in my opinion, led more parents to homeschooling.
Yeah.
Than had been in normal past generations. So the homeschooling numbers from Columbine, I think, really elevated, and maybe that would have been the biggest story of the 90s. Because of that. I mean, it would have been something that would have stretched into the 2000s because it happened so late in the decade. But, I mean, if we go back and look at it, I'd be hard-pressed to think that these numbers didn't go up because of the Columbine shooting and because of subsequent school shootings after Columbine.
I want to look that up after the show. You made an excellent point there, because I hadn't thought about that. I mean, we've heard more about the homeschooling movement as it's gone along, and I know that you happen to know a lot about alternate educational paths and everything like that. You may even know, you probably know more than I do about that, but I hadn't really made that connection. I know that it's been kind of growing, but yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, because if there's anything, Ryan, that would have added a jolt to that, that would have been the thing right there. The parents just getting the piss scared out of them by what happened.
Right, and it's a cause and effect thing, and it's kind of like the top five items on the FDH ebook was, you know, you kind of link Katrina with the war.
Yeah.
Because had there not been a war, there would have been more funds to help and more troops to go down and help out in Katrina. It goes back to Columbine, where if Columbine wouldn't have happened, what would the spike have been like in homeschooling?
Oh, yeah, and that was, I remember at the time, too, at the time of Katrina, you know, how it tied to the Gulf War. I just remember thinking about this, you know, and how horrific it would be, because I came across a thing. One of the charities that I've really, enjoyed linking to over the years and trying to promote is something called Soldiers Angels. And I believe we got it. I don't remember the exact URL. We got it on our links page. Let me give the URL, since I know we got it here. SABlogs.com. Okay, so Soldiers Angels. Anyways, they're a charitable unit devoted to helping out, families of soldiers, everything like that. But here's the thing, too. Where I first learned about them and started linking to them on the blog was during Katrina, because Soldiers Angels was involved in helping out with, like, you know, National Guard soldiers and everything like that from, like, Louisiana. Can you imagine how god-awful that would be? You know, you're halfway around the world in this quagmire, and it certainly was a quagmire in 2005, and then your family gets hit by, you know, just the natural disaster of the millennium while you're, I mean, I just remember thinking at the time, like, oh my God, this could there be, like, a more horrible confluence of circumstances than to have that happen to your family, Katrina and Iraq at the same time?
Well, and not only that, Katrina's one of those things where you look at it and full circle. I was working at Sears at the time, and we did what was called Heroes for Home, and we did it was a great charity where people could donate money, and we'd help out families of victims of the war. But then we did one that was kind of a spinoff of that for Katrina because of the magnitude. I mean, Rick, this was something that even if you don't live anywhere near Louisiana, your heart went out to these people. Because if you watch CNN, you were like, that's not the United States. There's no way that happened in our homeland. That happened. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would expect to happen in third world countries. Those kind of devastating, you know, occurrences. Hurricane Katrina, I think, really slammed it home that that kind of thing can happen in the United States. You know, we see wildfires in California all the time. We see, you know, tornadoes down through Tornado Alley, and we see hurricanes. But Hurricane Katrina was on such a bigger magnitude than anything I know I've ever seen in my lifetime as far as natural disasters. And I'm sure that, you know, you would agree with that as far as in your lifetime, things that you've seen don't even come close to Katrina.
Unfathomable. Some things are just so hard to wrap your mind around. And I remember at the time, it took somebody just saying, one of the blogs that I was reading with coverage, it took somebody just spelling it out in a sentence and saying, just think about this for a second. They said, we just lost a major metropolitan area. I mean, if you just wrap your mind around it, several hundred thousand people living in an area, and I've read stories about that of like people that flew over it and like no lights, no nothing. You might as well have been flying over the Kansas farmland for all the signs of life that there would have been below. The human mind can't even hardly wrap around the magnitude of something like that. A major metropolitan area, gone in a blink of an eye.
Well, not only that, I think that, you know, we saw all the footage on CNN, and I mean, obviously, unless you were there and you were in the middle of it, you know, you see people on these roofs trying to just survive. It wasn't, we're trying to get our house back, we're trying to get, no, they were just trying to survive and live. It wasn't a thing of, you know, well, we're losing this, we're losing our possessions. They were trying not to lose their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think what really brought it home to me, and it may seem trivial, but knowing that hearing the whole Mardi Gras thing, you know, Mardi Gras is never going to be the same. Mardi Gras, you know, they almost suspended it because of how bad Katrina was. And, you know, the economy in New Orleans, and, you know, you watch and you see Drew Brees really take part in that community when he came to the Saints. And the Saints players really welcoming these people into the Superdome and helping out in a community where, yeah, they're professional athletes, and they may not be from that area originally, but they now play there, and they took care of their own. And that, to me, was one of the most touching stories of the entire situation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that just shows you, again, you know, there's a lot of times where it gets hard to justify being as much into sports as we are. And, you know, when I have my dad ask me questions about what I think about, you know, the salaries people are making, amount of money. I mean, there's a lot of things about it that are disgusting that we just take along with it. But there are a lot of things that are inspiring also. And again, I've read some stories recently, and I think ESPN, for as much as I like to criticize them, their e-ticket things that they have, some of their in-depth articles that they have are just really outstanding. And there was one that they had, you know, when they really want to commit themselves to journalism, like they do with the 30 for 30 stuff, they're damn good. My criticism is when they're not sufficiently committed to journalism.
Oh, you mean when they try to become the National Enquirer of Sports?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just throwing that out there.
By the way, here's a tease. We got something coming up later in the show about an actual National Enquirer for Sports that is coming onto the market next year. We'll talk more about that. Thank you for throwing the ball up in the air for me to spike there on the tease. But it was
I'll be your Kerry Walsh anytime.
Yes, exactly. But this thing, if you read that article, or if anybody out there in the audience did, it was talking about how much the Saints have meant to people there, and how much, you know, and yeah, again, like I criticize a lot of times in Cleveland. There's a lot of people whose entire lives are wrapped up in the Cleveland Browns, and they're generally not the smartest fans because of how emotionally involved they are in it. You can take it to unhealthy extremes, but if you live in an area like New Orleans, you can kind of be inspired by that. You can look forward the entire week to Sundays. It's a thing the family looks forward to together. It's a thing to get invested in together. Mardi Gras, to an extent, also is the same thing, which, by the way, one of the weirdest things about all that is that the French Quarter never got battered like the rest of the city. I don't know why or how that is. It has to do with the geography.
It's because they were French and they were neutral.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the French and the, you know, white flag neutral, if you want to call it that. But that's, yeah, the thing about the Saints and what they do for the community down there, you raise an excellent point on that one. And the thing of it is, the stories, you know, the one that we haven't really talked about as much here, I mean, this would have been number one any decade, maybe going back to the 40s with World War II. But this the Great Recession, really, that kicked off last year. I mean, there are things that happened that were just, again, the word is unfathomable. That's what comes to mind. Much as you can't imagine planes flying into a building. And nobody could have imagined that before it happened as an act of terrorism. Nobody could have imagined we lose an entire metropolitan area. There And again, depending on what you believe about this, and I tend to believe a lot of it, when Lehman Brothers went down, I think it was September 15th of 08, I mean, when they ended up trying to cobble together that bailout package, which was unpopular, but I have always felt like unpopular, but I think they had to do something of that magnitude just to kind of keep things stabilized. I mean, there was talk about everything was going to collapse. You might get up tomorrow and your dollar might not have any purchasing power. I mean, we may never know how close we came to, like, Mad Max, you know, scenarios here, you know, driving around in a Jeep with an eye patch holding up people for, you know, with food stocks or whatever. You know, it's just this decade was just full of stuff that we just never could have imagined before.
Right. And, you know, the only decade I think that would have had anything close to it would have been the 60s when you've got JFK and Martin Luther King Jr. both dying. I mean, that's about the only other scenario I can think of that this wouldn't have been the number one story of the decade.
Yeah. You know what? You're right. There were a lot of shocks in the 60s with the assassinations. You're probably right about that. You know, the JFK thing, yeah. I mean, that aside from 9/11, that probably has been the biggest thing since World War II. But it's absolutely unbelievable the things that have happened. And it sort of shapes us going into this new decade here, too, because, you know, it's funny. When we started working on the ebook, back in October, it was to kind of fill a little bit of a void because I wasn't seeing a whole lot in the media. I wasn't seeing a lot of coverage of this change of the decade. Now, in the last couple weeks, others have kind of joined the party. You're seeing it everywhere, a lot of retrospective stuff. You know, and there's stuff, I don't remember if it was Time or Newsweek, but somebody did a thing on just what a crappy, god-awful, depressing decade it's been. And if you're looking at the headlines, I mean, boy, it's hard to argue with that. I mean, you could find some things in pop culture or sports or whatever that might have been great, but as far as real world stuff, it pretty much has sucked. The thing is, as you start to look ahead to the next decade, my God, it just, maybe it's because things still are pretty bad in a lot of areas right now, but it doesn't look like the next one's necessarily going to be any better. I mean, I hate to be a, you know, cyanide pill for anybody out there, but you've got the economic stuff, which still hasn't necessarily reversed itself. You've got Iran, which is about to have nukes, and not to go too far into that, but Israel has said that they're going to take them out if we don't. If that happens, Iran starts mining the Straits of Hormuz, which is where a good chunk of the world's oil supply goes through. And I've seen estimates of $400 a barrel oil if that happens. So, you know, if Israel does the thing they think they need to do in their own self-defense, we may be paying $15 a gallon for gas by the time it's all said and done. You got that. Unprecedented red ink in this country here. We're basically borrowing from China for, like, everything that we do. So, I mean, I hate to be depressing and everything like that. And we had a little bit of a round table in the ebook as far as looking ahead on these type of things to the future. And, you know, at least one of my two colleagues in there said, I don't know if it's going to be as bad all that, Rick. You know, we've gone through a lot of bad stuff before in this country, but I don't know, man. I'm pretty depressed when I look at that stuff. I just really am. I hate to be a pessimist.
I have a positive spin, possibly, on $15 gas.
What?
If gas goes $15 a gallon, people will start riding bicycles again, and maybe some of these fat-ass people in the United States will get back in shape. So maybe the United States won't be so freaking overweight anymore if gas goes $15 a gallon. Now, people like myself, I'm kind of ticked because I'm going to have to ride a bike, and I'm in pretty darn good shape, and I'm kind of small anyway, so I don't have any weight to lose.
You're going to have a long commute if that happens.
Right. But the other thing that you didn't really mention was basically the healthcare thing isn't solved yet either. I mean, there are so many what ifs about this next decade, more than I can remember going into this current decade, because of how bad the decade was. I mean, anybody that honestly is looking at this decade coming up through rose-colored glasses, they've got the glasses on because they're blind. There's really no hope. I mean, there's nothing to give you hope that this is going to be a great decade and that things are going to change. Looking back at the past 10 years, I mean, you can't really trend. I mean, yeah, 10 years is a big number, and you know, the next 10 years, the first couple of it may suck, and then maybe the next 8 will be great. But immediately, you don't see anything positive about the 2010s.
No, it doesn't look that way. And it's interesting, too, because you mentioned, you know, 10 years ago that we didn't have as much of a sense of what was going to happen. I would ascribe that in part to the fact that every other time you have a decade change, it's in the middle of a presidential election. So it's hard to get a grip on what's going to happen. I mean, we're 1 year into the Obama administration. We have a pretty good idea what 2010 and 2011 look like, at least from his perspective. We didn't know who our president was going to be for the first couple of years of the last decade. The last time that there was any kind of sense of what was going to happen ahead, it was way off. And we can only hope that it's the same way now, because when it was way off the last time, it was on the optimistic end. So hopefully we're way off on the pessimistic end. And that would be when the 80s turned into the 90s. We had just come off, you know, earlier in the year, you did have Tiananmen Square. But later in the year, boom, boom, boom. Everything in Eastern Europe with the Berlin Wall and everything like that. The thing that was funny was some historian, Francis Fukuyama, I think it was, wrote an article that said, and almost two decades later, you can't even hardly believe it. He said, it's the end of history. We now have a consensus on how governments are going to go in the world. And there's, you know, capitalism has won over communism. There will be no great strifes ahead. We've settled all the issues. You know, it's the end of history. You know, you look at, you know, even at the time it sounded weird, but 20 years later, you can't hardly believe it. So that guy was way off. We can only hope that we're way off right now. But I'm with you. I mean, what the hell's good to feel, you know, can we feel good about here? Now, there's the sense that, you know, Americans always regenerate, always find a way to climb up from the ashes and stuff. But if for no other reason than mountains of red ink, which have been accumulating like 30 and 40 years now, I don't know how you dig out from underneath it when you can't even pay for the basic things without borrowing from somebody. It just, I hate to say that we're screwed, but I mean, I wish I could find a reason to think that we're not.
Well, not only that, I mean, we've been chasing Osama bin Laden through the caves of Afghanistan for 8 or 9 years. We still can't find him. I mean, you go back to the weapons of mass destruction. You go back to, you know, the reason for launching the war. You go back to all of that stuff. And now Obama's kind of stuck in a position where there really was no exit strategy to begin with. So it's going to be almost impossible to come up with an exit strategy now. So when the hell do we have to think that that war is going to end in these next 10 years and that we're going to have all the troops home? There is no possible way that you could tell me that you think 100%, without a doubt, perfect conviction that the troops are all going to be home by the time we turn another decade because of the way that this has already been handled.
Right. Right. And it's, you know, you can't really get your arms around that. You can't really believe that that's necessarily going to be the case on that. And in a sense, Ryan, I think it's a self-defeating thing to, you know, I understand the concept of benchmarks and accountability, and that's a good thing. You have to have, but to publicize it at the same time where we're sending more troops, they're coming out in a year and a half. I can tell you something. Taliban, Al-Qaeda, they're patient. We are not. They've been living in caves forever. Year and a half to them is like 30 seconds to our attention deficit disorder society. So it's one of those things where it's going to be complicated getting out if things are still bad. I submit to you, things will still be bad if they think they can outweigh us. So I think it's self-defeating to get into these kind of things. I think benchmarks and accountability are good. I think putting it out there for some dude in a cave to just say, we're going to go into the four corners offense for the next 18 months is not so good.
Absolutely. And I mean, you think back to the day, and I'm sure you, another one of those moments where you know exactly where you were when it happened and what you were thinking. When the Saddam statue came down in the middle of Baghdad, how many of us at that point thought, this is it, the troops have done it, we've overtaken them, we're going to be bringing the troops home very soon? And I hate to tell you, but that's been 7 years.
Yeah.
And they're not home yet. You know, if anything, we're sending more family members over. You know, I've got a family member over there right now who's been over there for a few months, you know, since July, who went over there, and he's missing Christmas with his family for the first time because he's over defending our freedom, because there was no exit strategy and because there was real no plan going in, because we had a president who would rather read kids' books than find out what was actually going on in the United States under his watch. There were, we've never really figured it out and sat down and said, this is our strategy. Boom, boom, boom. We're going to be out by this time. We're going to go in. This is going to be the offensive. We're going to go in. We're going to get things taken care of. We're going to fix everything and bring everybody home. No, what we get is artificial dates. We get, well, we're going to bring them back in a year and a half, just like you said. That's 18 months. That's no time to these people. Okay, all they have to do is you're absolutely going to the Princeton offense. You just sit around. You play four corners offense until they leave. And then all of a sudden, you keep wreaking havoc like you've done in the past. Mm-hmm. The United States needs to keep under wraps what the plan is, but they also need to have a plan to begin with.
Right, right. And you know, I will say, too, that, you know, with what you just said there, with what you pointed out, I think that's why, you know, when you look at this here, we did have in our ebook here, when we look at the top newsmakers of the decade, I think it was number one with a bullet. I made the decision on this. George W. Bush, even ahead of Osama bin Laden, because, you know, he called himself the decider, and he was. And it's one of these things where, you know, in talking to my dad, who I think, you know, he's an example of somebody who has had, you know, and this is typical of a lot of people, and there are more people that are coming around to this point of view as time goes by, who will kind of defend Bush because of his distaste of some stuff happening. Now, I get that to a degree, but I don't let Bush off the hook in terms of, because again, I don't like the current crowd. But what I say to my dad is, he created Nancy Pelosi, he created Harry Reid, he created Barack Obama. Had things gone the way they were supposed to have gone, had the shop been minded, they would not be in power. And you cannot wash your hands of that. So the people out there like my dad who, you know, want to deny that, I just don't see that as being the case. If you don't like the current crowd now, and I count myself as somebody very strongly in that category, you can't help but point a finger back and say the conditions were created and people turned in this direction as a result of the things that happened. The war, Katrina, I mean, Katrina alone. I mean, George Bush was a lame duck. That was a very painful period in this country. We had essentially a lame duck president from the fall of 2005 going forward. That's a long, long, long time to have a president that nobody believes in.
Right, and it wasn't that we could have, it was somebody that could have been impeached at the same time. It wasn't an impeachable offense.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it was weird. I mean, it was a really weird time in this country from 05 to 08. You're absolutely right. I mean, just a couple of things that go the different way. The ball bounces the other way. George Bush becomes possibly one of the best presidents in the history of this country if the whole situation is handled differently. But the pendulum swings and it goes the complete opposite way. And now you've got people out there going, well, Barack Obama hasn't done anything. Well, it's impossible to expect a guy to do everything in 1 year to fix the problems of the last 4, 5, 6 years and not give him a chance. Whether you like Barack Obama or whether you don't like Barack Obama, the fact of the matter is he is the president of this country, and you need to give him a chance to at least do things his way. Because what's happened the last 5, 6 years didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it is a complete overhaul of what has happened, and maybe that's not the right way to do it, it was time for a new voice. It was time for a change. And obviously that was one of his slogans, is time for a change, that, you know, maybe we need to see what he can do. And you know, Dick Cheney is not without blame in all of this either.
Yeah.
I mean, Dick Cheney was the sidekick to George W. Bush, and a lot of people even thought that Dick Cheney was making some of these decisions instead of George W. Bush. So him being one of the most powerful vice presidents in mm-hmm. the history of this country cannot escape without blame, and it has nothing to do with not being a good quail hunter.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Number three on our list of the top newsmakers of the decade, I agree with that. And it's a circumstance where, and it's kind of ironic, and it's not an opinion that a lot of people share right now. I think it's an opinion more people are going to come around to. My biggest problems with Obama are areas where I had problems with Bush, and I think he's doubling down on what Bush did. Bush drowned this country in red ink. Obama's saying, I'll raise you some. You know, there's areas like that. The areas where I found fault with the previous administration, and this is, there are a lot of people that either haven't caught on to that yet or just don't agree with me, depending on what your side of the spectrum is. But it's really interesting. For all the talk of change and everything like that, and that's where, again, and a lot of people who share the same viewpoints as me. I've got, you know, friends like this who try to act like all the problems started on January 20th. And I say to them, look, that's, you got to be intellectually honest about this. You have to be intellectually honest to say problems were inherited. Are there things being done making those problems worse? I happen to think so. A lot of people happen to think so. But you can't be intellectually dishonest and act like, you know, it was the Garden of Eden on January 20th.
No, you can't think that just because Barack Obama took over, you can't exactly expect him to wipe the slate clean in one day. I mean, let's give the guy a chance. We gave George Bush 8 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. He had 8 years to do this. We've now given Barack Obama less than 1 year since his inauguration. It's been 11 months and 2 days. 11 months and 3 days, something like that, since his inauguration. I mean, do you really expect him to get this country out of debt, have health care figured, have this figured, have that figured, have all the troops home? It was impossible. He was put in a very bad situation to begin with. While I agree with you, you know, and I'll be honest, I'll be, you know, right out there, I was a Barack supporter, you know, when this all went down last year. There are things that he could have done better. There are things that you're absolutely right. He has doubled down, and, you know, I'd love to play poker with George W. Bush and President Obama because I could afford Christmas gifts if I would play poker with these guys right now. I mean, but there are other things that you have to give him time to work on when you don't give a guy a year. I mean, I hate to kind of make it an analogy. I mean, Eric Mangini has come in and completely screwed up the Browns. Mm-hmm. President Obama hasn't come in and completely screwed up the United States.
Because again, things were bad when he got in there, and people will agree or disagree about whether he's made things worse. Again, I've said, you know, I'm pretty firmly on the made it worse side. But yeah, I mean, that's a different thing than me trying to act like things, because again, if things were, you know, that great, he wouldn't have gotten elected in the first place. The country wouldn't have turned in that direction. The other thing I will say, too, in looking ahead to the next decade, you know, as we've got a, you know, projected newsmakers list there, and we've got Obama projected as the number one newsmaker of the next decade. But all I will say is, I've been saying all along here, for everybody that said, and I realize I'm a homer on the subject here, all the Sarah Palin's got no chance. Sarah Palin's got, look at the polls right now, and polls are always just a snapshot. They're almost even. What I've been saying is 2012 is a long ways away. Now, maybe Obama's up 30 on her by the time 2012 rolls around. But do people even realize what a lifetime that is? Because I'll tell you what, if the consensus becomes that things were bad and have gotten worse, whoever's running on the other side is going to beat him, just like whoever was running against the Republicans the last time was going to beat them. So it all depends on what the facts
on
the ground are.
It depends on how many jobs Sarah Palin quits between now and then. I'm sorry, cheap shot.
Her job as author is going pretty well based on the bestseller list. Although the funny thing is, I'm getting her book from my dad for Christmas. Last week I got, have you seen the parody book, Going Rouge?
Yes.
I got that from my brother and my sister last week, which was pretty funny. So I've got them both now. But, you know, There's again, it's been, you know, a bummer of a decade, huge headlines and stuff, and that's why I wanted to open the show on this note here, just because so much consequential stuff. When we look at it in terms of pop culture and other stuff, that's kind of our next focus here. I was talking to a good friend of ours, Lloyd Carroll, who is not going to be able to join us here tonight on the show because he's a little bit under the weather and doesn't want to come on with a froggy voice, which I can kind of understand, but I hope he feels better. But he was saying last night, in a lot of ways, it just feels like there's unfinished business. It doesn't feel like we've been through a whole 10 years. And one of the things that just jumps out at me, and we talked about this in the ebook here, musically, there's nothing that really ties things together. You know, 90s, grunge. You know, maybe later in the decade, the return of some of the teen bands. 96, there was like a 5-minute span of electronica. But, you know, but grunge is probably the one main thing people think of. Maybe the rise of hip-hop, whatever. In the 80s, all the techno garbage that I grew up on, where I couldn't escape from, you know, Howard Jones on the radio tormenting me and, you know, all of the other, you know, Culture Club and, you know, Wham and everything like that. What got innovated in this decade? And I'm thinking to myself, like, the only thing I can think of as far as penetrating the mainstream would be emo. And that, even that's not something that was on the tip of everybody's tongue. But as far as, like, what kind of new style came out there, what are we going to think of when we think of the decade? We're going to think of a lot of some of this pop stuff that's out there. We're going to think of a couple different things. You know, you had the new metal carrying over, but that was at the beginning of the decade. What got innovated this decade like we had in past decades and stuff? I can't really think of much of anything.
Musically, the one thing that made it through the entire decade, there's one person who was at the beginning of the decade and has gotten stronger as it's gone on and is still strong today. Jay-Z.
Yeah, okay.
Jay-Z has been that one person in this decade that when you think music, you're going to think back and go, man, Jay-Z was an absolute freaking genius for the entire 10 years of that decade.
Okay.
I mean,
well,
look at how great the Blueprint 3 has been.
Yeah.
The Blueprint 3 was his last release this year and has been just as good, if not better, than anything that he's put out.
Okay. I'll give you that. But, you know, he's a guy who, you know, that's, in a way, that's sort of like talking about Springsteen in this decade or Madonna of the last decade. He's a guy who carried over because, you know, he really made his bones in the 90s and kind of carried over. But, you know, you raise a good point there. The thing I found weird was, I think, I don't know if it was Billboard or somebody gave Eminem Artist of the Decade. And I'm going, what? I mean, he was everywhere the first couple of years. And he's done some things in the last year or two or whatever, but he's never been as omnipresent as he was up until about, what, 02, 03, somewhere in there.
Right. He didn't have the music to sustain the entire decade.
Right.
I mean, honestly, hands down, I would say that Jay-Z was the artist of the decade in some retrospects because of, I mean, you look back to 2001 when he, you know, 2001, 2002, when the original Blueprint came out. And, you know, he kind of left, kind of did some producing, came back, did the Blueprint 2, did the Black album. And then he came back and did Blueprint 3, which was just, like I said, one of the best albums. God, I sound old saying album. But one of the best albums I have bought in a long time. I mean, it takes a lot for an artist to make me buy their CD anymore. I mean, I have to hear more than one good song on a CD to go out and spend 9, 10, 11 bucks on it. I heard the first two cuts that came out from that CD. I went and bought the CD immediately. And immediately, those two weren't my favorite tunes on the CD because the CD was that darn good. So for him to come out at the end of the decade and bring something so brilliant, so different, there were so many different styles of music on that CD, it's just is mind-boggling that somebody has that kind of genius.
It is. And it's funny, too, because the New York Bureau emailed me the Rolling Stone Top 100 Songs of the Decade and Billboard Top 100 Albums of the Decade, and it's why I loathe music critics with a passion, because it's all this pretty much gaga from top to bottom on there. And one of the things that just jumps out at me, not represented on either list, Top 100, mind you, that covers a lot of ground. That's 10 things per year, my rudimentary grasp of math tells me. All right, and I'm up front about stuff where I'm a homer, okay? I'm a homer for Linkin Park, at least up until their last album, when they sold out to the chick rock stations. But Hybrid Theory is probably my favorite album of all time. Okay, and that was one of, if not the biggest seller of the decade. I don't think it was the biggest seller, but it was very close. Not represented on the top 100 albums of the decade. None of the songs from there or from any of their other albums represented on the top 100 songs of the decade. So that is one of the constants from decade to decade. There's always a disconnect between, and I can't believe I'm defending Vox Populi because they're the same people that are foisting Taylor Swift on us and the Jonas Brothers and everything like that. But once in a while, once in a tiny while, people get it right. Everybody that went out there and bought Hybrid Theory, I think it sold like, what, 28 million, whatever it was, and they can't get a sniff on these lists here. Here's your top 10 songs of the decade. Crazy, Hey Ya, Seven Nation Army, can't argue with that, and always great at Ohio State games. Crazy in Love, Lose Yourself, Beautiful Day, Clocks, Last Night, Paper, Planes, and 99 Problems. Can't argue with 99 Problems. Top 10 albums of the decade. Radiohead, Kid A, The Strokes, Is This It, Wilco, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, The Strokes and Wilco, you know, had to be on there. Jay-Z, The Blueprint, there you go. White Stripes, Elephant, Arcade Fire, Funeral, Eminem, The Marshall Mathers LP, Bob Dylan, Modern Times, M.I.A., Kayla, and Kanye West, The College Dropout. So, you know, I just look at those and I shake my head, Ryan.
Hey, Kanye, before you go, I you know, I don't want to interrupt you, but you didn't have the best album of the decade. Hey, you know, though, if you listen to music now, did you know that it's going to be a good night?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a feeling it's going to be a good night. Because the Black Eyed Peas are on every freaking station that you turn on anymore.
Now, see, that I'm glad you mentioned that. Let's segue to that point. Because one of the things that we did in our ebook here, I had a round table with our entertainment editor for FDH, Samantha Jones, and then, you know, hubby Jason Jones, our senior editor, who is our sort of de facto assistant entertainment editor, because, you know, they watch all their movies together and they partake in
all
the same
things. That cute?
Exactly, you know, couple stuff. But Jason's got a lot of the same interests and stuff. So it was a fun round table.
Well, it was a good thing they got married then.
Yeah, they... That was the funny thing is, I think the last time she was on here, I was hoping to hear from them tonight, but in as much as her parents just flew out to Denver to visit them today, I'm not holding my breath. But the last time she was on, our intro in the system still said Samantha Scheidemantle. It still had her maiden name on there. So
nice. And she was also in our college basketball team draft as well.
Yes. And you know, so it's always, you know, and people are going to have fun reading through on some of the stuff there. Samantha is, and I say this as a decidedly unhip person, she is very hip. You see some of her recommendations on that and stuff people should check out, and it's just way too hip for me. But Samantha's got a good grasp on that, and she's, you know, and the thing I like about her, you know, she's not the obnoxious, wearing black, pretentious person. She just, you know, naturally happens to have these tastes. But we're talking about stuff. One of the questions I put to them was, and I go back again, it's scalded into my brain, you know, growing up in the 80s, you know, and as I met the aforementioned Howard Jones and Wham and other things like that, you couldn't escape it, okay? Versus this decade, what's some of the biggest stuff out there? Taylor Swift, the Jonas Brothers, whatever. I couldn't hardly
Carrie Underwood.
I couldn't name you hardly anything from any of them. We have finally gotten to the point where we can wall ourselves off. Now, but what you mentioned, though, you know, that's one instance of where the Black Eyed Peas can break through. Lady Gaga, you can't escape it. It's like a throwback to when I was growing up.
Why would you want to escape something like that?
It's a guilt. I take that. I've said before, I have no guilty pleasures. I proudly like ABBA. I proudly like everything that I like. I have no sense of shame. I like a lot of Lady Gaga stuff. I just, if I had shame, I'd be ashamed of that.
If you saw the Elle magazine cover for this month, you would never dislike Lady Gaga again.
Does she address the hermaphrodite rumors in there?
I didn't look at it to read it, Rick.
Okay, all right. Well, let me ask you this then. Is there anything you could tell from the cover that answers the question one way or another?
I'm thinking she's not.
Okay, all right. An educated guess, I'm sure. But anyways, they're like the exception to the rule. Black Eyed Peas, Lady Gaga, I'm sure we could think of one or two other things like that to where you can't escape it, or if you wanted to or whatever. But I can tune out Taylor Swift. I can live my life and never hear any of her crap. Jonas Brothers, you know, that's one of the things that changed in this decade too. Things are getting, I don't want to say segregated because that word always gets taken in a racial context, but balkanized, however you want to call it. You can wall yourself off basically just in stuff that you like, and I don't think that was the case 10 years ago.
Well, the problem I'm having, and this is what we do at my other job, we sit there and, you know, there's three of us in an office, so one of us always has our computer on music, and we always flip it to like a mix station so that we can hear a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to you, without exception, every day in an 8-hour day, we hear Black Eyed Peas, I Got a Feeling, at least four times.
Mm-hmm.
We hear at least four or five times we hear Taylor Swift.
Okay.
I mean, it's the same. Carrie Underwood's Cowboy Casanova. Oh, my God, can I please quit hearing that song? Can she please come out with something different? Write something about the hockey player you just got engaged to or something,
mm-hmm,
so I can quit hearing this stupid song. But It doesn't matter. Every time we flip it to a different station, it's the same thing. I mean, we can almost give you the playlist every day of what we're going to hear. And it gets really old after a while, and then you wonder why people don't buy CDs anymore. It's because they can't stand hearing the same song over and over on the stations.
Right. And that's what we've gotten to, too. You know, we're in a world now where because of the capacity to download stuff with online stations that have sprung up, people really are at a point now where they can pick and choose. You know, it's a more consumer, you know, oriented thing like that if you want to escape. I mean, it may take a little bit of effort, but, you know, there's even some stations online. My sister-in-law was telling me about one of them last week where you can kind of customize the kind of music that it'll play for you now. Increasingly, you're having stuff like that as a revolt, as a reaction against that, against a terrestrial radio business that is dying on the vine. I mean, newspapers look like an outstanding business model compared to terrestrial radio. Terrestrial radio sucks, and people are in open revolt. You know, it's just one of those things where, you know, that's what's driving things to the internet, to satellite, to the other options that are out there. And really, that's becoming a haven for people, you know, as well as YouTube also. And that's something I think that ties into our pop culture thing, too, because you look at it was around 2005 when YouTube came out. And in a lot of ways, it's hard to remember what things were like before then as far as stuff. I mean, I was telling my sister-in-law last week, you know, anything I don't have on iTunes, if I'm sitting at home, I like to have music on when I'm working on stuff. And everybody that knows how much I bang away on my FDH stuff at home, it seems like, you know, I'm a multitasker. I might be in front of the TV, working on stuff, listening to music. Anything I don't have on iTunes, Ryan, I can find it on YouTube. It's like, well, oh, I haven't got a chance to download this song yet, and I'm too lazy to do it right now, so let's hear it on YouTube. Which led to the one time when I was trying to listen to Drift and Die by Puddle of Mud and inadvertently keyed in the wrong words there and probably came up with a good parody band, Puddle of Judd. That was an interesting thing that came up for me there. I'd love to hear what that would sound like.
That's interesting. It's kind of a different thing. And speaking of YouTube, you know, a case in point with this show, you know, I ran the new FDH promo right before the show, used the MLB on Fox Baseball theme. Where do you think I got that from? Yep. I got it from YouTube. I did my little Christmas jingle, I want to wish you guys a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from, you know, me at STC, Ryan Isley. And I used behind it, and I love the MVP puppet commercials. I love the part where LeBron's like, dunking on a reindeer, dunking on a reindeer, dunking on a reindeer. And then shout out to my Akron people. Well, me being from Akron, I went to YouTube. I found the commercial. I ran it into our system, and I used that behind my Christmas theme. So, I mean, we use YouTube a lot here in this business, not just at home. And I mean, I watch things on YouTube all the time. You can go on and just hit, you know, highlight after highlight after highlight for sports games or whatever. And yeah, it's a fantastic way to get new media and to get things like that when you don't really want to have to search for it. All you got to do is go to YouTube, type in whatever it is, and you're going to find something close.
It's amazing. It's that video on demand world, and we're still moving towards that. We've got another segment in here that I should plug also. Simon Applebaum, our good friend who we had on the show, I think it was either our last episode or the one before that. We've got another interview with him in here.
Yeah, I believe it was actually on the 9th, which would have been our last live show.
Okay, yeah. Simon's great. You got to love these futurist guys that have a handle on where we're going with this kind of stuff. And we were talking about video on demand and where it's going with TV, and it's probably going to catch up to TV in the next 10 years. And you're probably going to, you know, by the end of the decade, I think it'll be fully embedded into what we expect. But we've seen the important beginning steps of it with YouTube. I mean, because, you know, and you look at places like Hulu that are carrying TV shows. You go on to Hulu. I know a couple weeks ago when the, you know, that stupid thing of where, you know, The Office was blacked out because of the Browns Steelers game being on. I'll just wait a day and go on to Hulu and watch it. That thing with YouTube there. Here's the thing, Ryan. Let me tell you this. We've got in the course of the ebook here some poll quotes. I made some editorial decisions here on things that people said that I thought needed to be blown up. Here's one from Samantha. I watch a lot of YouTube, so much so that I've suggested that we no longer need cable. My husband just responds with dirty looks.
Well, and you know what, Rick? I was laughing because while you were chatting about YouTube, I decided just to try something myself.
Okay.
I went on to YouTube, and I put in the search box, put the hot sauce in the bag.
Mm-hmm.
First thing that pops up is the Delonte West KFC thing. Put the hot sauce in the bag. Got the hot sauce. I mean, it's you hear a catchphrase or anything like that. You go to YouTube, you put it in, and something like that pops up.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah, you just with snippets, with phrases, with whatever of things here. You know, and if we're talking about technology and where things are going with that as a part of our pop culture thing here, you cannot ignore the fact that 2009, in many ways, was the year of YouTube. And I'll sneak this in here quickly to say that the YouTube that I was afraid if I was going to lose the Time Person of the Year draft, if I was going to lose it to anybody, I thought it might have been to the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Cervillo, for taking the Twitter.
Let me just clap and applaud you.
Thank you.
For waiting an entire hour to drop that on us that you won the Time,
Time
Magazine Person of the Year draft because of Ben Bernanke.
My restraint is impressive sometimes.
Thank you for the field in that one, by the way.
Yes. No. He was my third round pick.
Did you take Bernanke, actually?
He was. Now, that was a thing where having the field.
Oh, that's right. You did. That's right, because we were talking about it after the show. You did take Bernanke.
And I had people telling me, I think it was Chris Galloway, one of the other dignitaries who I spoke with in the book, the day that we did the chat feature for the book, he said to me, he's like, "You're crazy, Rick. They're not going to take Bernanke. They're going to take somebody more recognizable to the American people." And I just said, "Nah, I just think it's a serious year. They're going to go for a serious person, a symbol of the economic crisis." That's what they ended up doing. The thing is, the one where the field would have gotten it for me was the Chinese worker. That was one of the finalists. It was the Chinese worker. One of those goofy things.
10 cents a day, we make you sweatshirts.
Nice.
Sorry.
Nice.
Sorry, I'm probably getting fired on that one.
Chance, yeah, hey, what the hell? I did my Charles Wong impersonation a couple weeks ago with no consequences, so that's all good. But the thing is, on that, with the Twitter execs. I thought if I was going to lose to anybody, I was going to lose to Cervillo on that one because it was the year of Twitter. I mean, right down to the Iranian, unfortunately, it wasn't a revolution. The mullahs are still there. But the uprising over the summer, as much as they were able to use Twitter to coordinate stuff like that with mobile phones and everything like that, I'll just use an example now of how Twitter, you know, impacted my life 2 weeks ago through something actually pretty asinine, but it's a hell of a story. Shaq is now up to, it was 2.65 million followers on Twitter last week. It's probably 2.66 million or 2.67 at the rate of growth he's at right now. Shaq loves to do his
the rate of growth Twitter-wise or the rate of growth waistline-wise?
Well, either or. He loves to do these random acts of Shaqness. He did one where he put the shoes out on the side of the road on 480. This was the night of the Heisman Trophy thing of being on TV. I'm sitting there at my place with my friend. We just gotten back from an awesome buffet called the Double Dragon. So we're sitting there with 5 pounds of sodium apiece in us. That's what we blame our decision on. I read this on Twitter. I look at him. He looks at me. I look at him. He looks at me. The next thing you know, we're in my car, and we're heading out. And before you know it, I've made the asinine decision to pull over on the side of the road on Interstate 480 in town here, and we're looking for them damn shoes and bobblehead. And the best part was, we see a car pulled off on the side of the road, blocking a lane by the exit, where somebody walked out of his car and headed down, probably the same guy who kept responding to Shaq going, "I've been here for 4 hours and can't find anything yet." That was probably the guy. As I'm walking up towards another signpost, I see a car pull over in front of me, slow down, slow down, slow down, look by the point there, and then keep going. Somebody else who obviously saw the same thing. So I would have needed some other way to horribly misspend my evening had it not been for Twitter previously. That's the power of this stuff to reach people.
Well, and the other thing is, and I know that TJ Zuppi and I, who do Tip Off tonight here on SportsTalkCleveland.com from 6 to 7 Monday through Friday, shameless plug. Yeah, usually when we go on the air, like we did the last hour of Greg Gazarek's show yesterday. So immediately we both went to our Twitter page and we put on there, "Hey, we'll be doing Gazarek's show and then Tip Off tonight." And a lot of people saw it and a lot of people, you know, retweeted back.
Mm-hmm. That's the power to be able to communicate this type of stuff, too. And it's been used in a lot of ways by celebrities. That's been another counterpoint to this, too. A lot of celebrities have been on Twitter. A lot of celebrities use it for things like what we saw this past week here. And again, 2009 is probably the epitome of that in this decade. Maybe I'm just saying it because it's the most recent and therefore the most embedded in my mind. But I think it's the most commonly associated one with celebrity deaths. We've talked about that before, 2009. And it's one of these things where, in talking to Mike before the show, Brittany Murphy, another one last week, unfortunately keels over, only at age 32, which is almost the very definition of, before her time. And it's just been an odd thing like that. One of the phenomena that is not going away from here on in, instant communication. You're seeing a lot of celebrities who are going on to Twitter to respond to this. And that's an interesting thing, too. And that's what we tried to talk to Simon Applebaum about 10 years from now. Where's this stuff going to be? Where are we going to be 10 years from now? This instant communication that Twitter and these other things kind of represent isn't going away. We don't know what the manifestations are going to be in 2020. We tried like heck to put our finger on it on this ebook because it's fun to do. And it's fun in a time capsule kind of a way also here. We'll be able to see 10 years from now, where were we right, where were we wrong. But as far as technology and other things like that, one of the things that Simon had to say, and I would urge you to read the interview with him in its entirety just to pick up all the nuggets of what he had to drop. I asked him about sporting events, big things like the Super Bowl. Where's that going? Is that going to be available on ways other than standard broadcast networks? His prediction is everything is going towards a three-screen world. At some point in the decade, you're going to have the Super Bowl on a TV channel. The Super Bowl will also be on a website, almost certainly affiliated with the TV channel. So those two ways, and the third way will be on your phone screen. And Simon is saying there will be different features available on each. So it'll be like maybe like go to your Sprint phone for such and such enhanced coverage of the Super Bowl. It might be something different on the internet and then on TV, the standard type thing. You're hearing now about TV is moving towards with some of these sporting events. You'll be able to pick your camera angles and stuff. You'll be able to call it from the truck. What angles you want to see? I mean, we're looking at something here, Ryan, where way more so than it was 10 years ago. 10 years into the future, I think it will be almost completely unrecognizable from sitting here at the turn of the decade.
Right, and if you remember back, ESPN kind of did something like this last year, and I believe it. I may be wrong, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure somebody will call and tell me I'm wrong. Duke-Carolina basketball game. Do you remember this? They did. ESPN had the regular feed.
Yep.
ESPN2 had like a feed with the coaches or something like that, and then ESPNU had a different feed. I mean, they've tried things like that with TV channels, where you get different things on each channel. Now to expand it a little bit more using the internet and using your phone, a great example of that is I'm down at, went with the family and the girlfriend down to Amish country a couple Saturdays ago. We're walking around these, little flea markets and things, and much to my ears perk up because I hear somebody talking about Ohio State basketball, and I hear an Ohio State basketball game going on, and I'm going immediately. Where is that coming? Where is that coming? So I start walking around all these booths. There's a guy in there selling cornhole boards, watching the Ohio State Butler game on ESPN360.com on his laptop.
Wow!
So I sat there and watched a couple minutes of the game with him, and kept coming back every 10 minutes or so for updates.
That's amazing. That just shows you again. We're getting tantalizing little tips here, and we're going to talk more about sports and sports media a little later in the hour. We're getting signs of where this is going. But again, 10 years from now, we'll look back on 2009, even 2010, and just say, man, it was like a completely different day and age to watch this kind of stuff. The other pop culture stuff before we move on to our last subject before we take our break. In terms of movies, there were, the usual standard popcorn movies that I think dominated the decade. The summer thrillers. Samantha Jones, our entertainment editor, making the very good point in the ebook that it's become a cycle that feeds on itself. These things draw big audiences. That leaves more money for the next blockbuster, which means better CGI, new generation computer stuff. It's become sort of a positive spiral there of where the budgets are increasing, the special effects are getting better, people turn out every summer. It's one of the things it's proven in the last year, even in a bad economy. You can, and with rising ticket prices, you'll still get people to turn out and watch this kind of stuff. So it's been an interesting, you know, decade for movies. Again, nothing particularly reinventing the genre, so to speak, Ryan, but you know, you can't necessarily say more of the same since the 90s, because it's been continued evolution with special effects, with more comic adaptations, and some of the other changes around the margins.
I think the one that we would talk about that maybe was a little bit cutting edge was the latest Batman.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was the one where your special effects, and to me, as a, I'm not a big movie buff, okay? I'll throw that out there right now. You ask me if I've seen a movie, I'm probably going to say no. I just don't watch a lot of movies. But I did go see that in the theaters. I love the special effects. There was a lot of them, but almost an overexplosion of them, to where there were scenes that you just really couldn't see the scene because there were so many special effects going on at one time that they almost went full bore instead of reeling it back in a little bit. And to me personally, I thought that hurt the movie a little bit.
That's true. I feel like it kind of did also, from the parts. I haven't seen the whole movie, but the pieces that I've seen, that has been the case. And then the other thing here with pop culture also, just with celebrities, and as I said, 2009 was huge for celebrity deaths. None bigger in terms of the coverage anyways than Michael Jackson. You had some similar things earlier in the decade, Anna Nicole Smith and some other things of that nature. 2009 was probably the biggest one for that, but it was the biggest year of the decade, I would have to think, in terms of that. But it's still a celebrity-obsessed culture. It's something that's allowed TMZ to really come up and become a monster. I will say this too. I can announce now, coming to the show in the next month here, I've been told, in the month of January, good old Perez Hilton will be joining us here on the FDH Lounge, so we'll be sure to ask him and get his thoughts on that. That should be one of the more interesting culture clashes that we've seen thus far in the lineage of the FDH Lounge. The only other topic to get to prior to taking our break, and we're a little behind on time, so it'll be a relatively quick one, on that of sports entertainment. And it may be a little misleading to say we ended the decade with the remnants of the Monday Night Wars. We start the new decade with that because it's a one-shot deal. But it's very interesting. The first Monday night of the new decade, head-to-head on Monday nights. Hulk Hogan comes to TNA. Bret the Hitman Hart rejoining the WWE. Well, actually joining the WWE for the first time. Last time he was there was the WWF. But that's a little pedantic probably for me to note that. But anyways, it was the dying embers.
Yeah, don't go
of the
to
battle.
WWE.com, because then you'll just learn about panda bears.
Yes, yes.
Or WWF.com, I'm sorry.
Yes, that.
The World Wildlife Foundation.
Exactly. Which, the way that came about in 2002, it's funny, because Vince had promised them, that was the whole crux of that. You're not allowed to market outside the United States. You can keep the WWF initials, but if you can't market outside. Vince was like, okay, sure, fine, because he never imagined the internet. All of a sudden, the internet comes along. You can't do business without it inherently going outside the border. It's like, oh, crap, they're going to sue us. And they did, and they won the rights to it, whatever. So we'll see what happens. To me, the story of the decade, and it's the number one story for sports entertainment in the ebook as far as how we rank them, the WWE blew it. They won the war, but just about everybody that watched WCW went away. And I was the channel surfing guy who did that. But, Ryan and everybody else, look, I still watch some stuff. Nothing to me is must-see like it was. Every Monday night, I had to be there. I had to channel surf. I'm there. It's on. I might be like that on January 4th, but I'm not going to be like that too many times. I don't think it's ever going to get as good as it did.
The problem is, Rick, and you're exactly the same way I am, I think. You know, back when that war was going on, you couldn't help but watch both shows and see what was going to happen. I mean, it was Monday, and it was must-watch TV on Monday nights. I mean, I was a big wrestling guy. I had to see what was going to happen. This last week, what I did is I DVR'd Monday Night Raw. When football was over, I went back and I watched Monday Night Raw and fast-forward.
Yeah.
Because there's really nothing anymore to grab my attention. They keep the same storylines, and they drag them out and drag them out. And also, do you remember back when wrestling was good and there was a pay-per-view maybe every 3-4 months?
Yep.
Now they're every 3-4 weeks.
Yep.
I mean, you just can't you can't oversaturate your population like that. And I think that's unfortunately what the WWE has done.
No, you can't. You absolutely can't. The thing that we did for wrestling, we did this for legitimate sports as well, but lists of this. Here's our list of the top 10 wrestlers of the 2000s. Number 10, Randy Orton. Number 9, Edge. 8, Chris Jericho. 7, Kurt Angle. 6, Shawn Michaels. 5, Steve Austin. 4, The Rock. 3, The Undertaker. 2, John Cena. And 1, Triple H. And it just shows you what an underwhelming decade it was when you look at that list there. I mean, the biggest stars of the decade, The Rock and Steve Austin, weren't around for a good part of the decade, and that's one of the reasons that the boom went in the crapper.
Well, and you look at the list that you have from the 90s, and you compare it to the 2000s, you got Goldberg at 10, Nash at 9,
yeah,
Flair at 8,
depth.
Undertaker 7, Shawn Michaels 6, Sting 5, Bret Hart 4, The Rock 3, Hogan 2, Steve Austin 1. You would take that list against that list of 2000, and 10 times out of 10, you're going to prefer to watch that list of the 1990s.
Oh, absolutely. The other thing is here, too, for honorable mention, what's amazing, this is what a weak decade it was. Hulk Hogan makes the honorable mention list.
As does Batista. I mean, it's just one of those decades that really was not very good when it came to WWE.
No, it wasn't. I mean, Hogan's got to be on the list because we think of him as being mostly retired in the decade, and he was. But huge match against The Rock, one of the most memorable WrestleMania matches of all time, WrestleMania 18 in Toronto. Match against Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam. Randy Orton at SummerSlam, that was the real political stroke right there. They're trying to build Randy Orton into the next company heel, but Hulk Hogan wants to go over, and he goes over. So there was that. There was those matches that were very memorable. He had a rematch with The Rock, which people don't tend to remember quite as much. The match with Vince McMahon at WrestleMania. But that's the thing. He was not a regular at any point, save for like two minor stretches with WWE. But he managed to be front and center. He leveraged himself onto pay-per-view main events or semi-main events. He wouldn't have made the 90s list doing that. There was way too much depth in the 90s for a guy to come in, do some one-shots, and get yourself onto honorable mention.
Well, and the problem with The Rock as well is when you go to the 2000s, you look at it and you go, well, yeah, he was here for this, but then he was gone because he was making a movie. Then he was here for this, and then he was gone because he was making another movie.